You're listening to This Motorcycle Life, conversations about why we ride. Episode 38, Thunderstruck. I'm Bruce Philp, and thank you for listening. Well, if you had to do it all over again, how far would you go to have motorcycling in your life? If nobody made a bike you could ride, would you build it yourself? If nobody wrote a book or made a skills video you could use, would you invent your own? And if nobody understood why you wanted to do this, would you have what it takes to do it anyway? Well, in a moment, you're going to meet someone who did all of those things just to get on two wheels. And if you're ready for a reminder of how fortunate we all are to do this, well, you've come to the right place. We'll get to that conversation in a moment. But first, this. I am always grateful for your emails and podcast ratings, but this month was a bit unusual. Bear with me here because it's kind of a winding tale. I received several emails from listeners who noticed that my last couple of interviews seemed to be flowing better, that I seemed to have somehow hit my stride, as one writer put it. Well, this was especially helpful to me because there's something most listeners don't know about how this podcast gets produced. The internet connection that I rely on to do these interviews is by satellite, and the weakness of that technology is something called latency, which means that there's a delay of sometimes several seconds between me asking a question and my guest answering it. Well, it doesn't make for very natural conversations, and it's an editing nightmare to make the pace easy to listen to. So the last couple of episodes were recorded using my mobile data plan, if you can imagine, and I think you could hear the difference. Unfortunately, it's also expensive, so I've decided to try selling podcast merch. Well, keep an eye on my website. My store should be up soon. And if you want to treat yourself to a coffee mug or a t-shirt, well, that would help me out a lot. And it might even make this podcast better. Well, I guess I kind of buried the lead there, didn't I? But check it out anyway, won't you? And while I'm taking advantage of your generosity, a reminder that the Movember Foundation still very much needs our help, and that you can contribute by simply clicking on the mustache in my show notes. Congratulations to everyone who participated in this year's 10th annual Distinguished Gentleman's Ride. A lot of listeners rode that day, as it turns out, but a little extra respect goes to friend of the podcast, Tom, who rode his 67 Shovelhead Bobber for the occasion, and made it home, literally, thanks to duct tape. Sense of humor intact. Nice job, Tom. That is commitment. And speaking of commitment, why don't we get started? Well, of all the many things that motorcyclists have in common, and that we've talked about on this show, the one that makes for the best stories is the role that struggle and sacrifice play in our riding lives. We never seem to tire of stories of people who face uncertainty and even danger, sometimes simply to prove to themselves that they can overcome it. Well, it's been a theme of many of these podcasts in one way or another, this decision to set out on a journey of some kind in order to, as T.S. Eliot put it, arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Well, I've often wondered if this is partly because each of us, in some personal way, did exactly that in order to become riders in the first place. Maybe it was to overcome something, like fear or loss, or maybe it was a way to figure out who we are, or some inner voice telling us that it was time to start our lives over again. But I really think that somehow, many of us, and probably more than would admit it, undertook some private version of that hero's journey, just to become motorcyclists. And I think that every ride is like its own little story that allows us to relive that victory, and that maybe that's where some of the magic comes from. And should we ever forget this, if riding becomes routine, which I suppose it could, all it takes for those feelings to come flooding back is to be around someone whose struggle is still fresh. And suddenly, we remember how amazing it is to do this. And suddenly, it's new again. And that's the reason I thought you should meet Angie Sandow. Well, as you'll hear, I struggled a bit with how to introduce Angie. She rides motorcycles, and she's a passionate enthusiast. She's also a pretty fearless character. And like many of us, Angie came back to riding later in life, which is brave enough, if you ask me. But that she did it having been born with only one hand, well, that's where the story really begins, and you really need to hear her tell it. I reached Angie Sandow at her home in Mississauga, Ontario. Hey, Angie, thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm wonderful. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Wonderful, that's a brave answer. That's a, good for you.
Well, you know, what it could be.
Well, you know, actually, I was going to say, you look pretty happy to me last weekend, if Instagram is to be believed. You know, great riding weather was finally here, and I think you got some miles in. That looked like a pretty big smile. So I'm going to accept wonderful as your answer.
Oh, good, because, you know, we've got more plans for this weekend. So anytime I think of that motorcycle and getting on it, the smile comes out.
Well, look, I'm gonna start off by asking you to do something I have never asked a guest to do, which is to introduce yourself, and I'll explain why. I think when people look at your story, they might say that life has given you some, you know, difficult cards to play. But I've met you. It's been, you know, a few years, but I have met you, and that is not at all how I remember you. You struck me as a sort of super positive, empowered person who loves to ride bikes, maybe a little hint of mischief in there somewhere. And so I'm not really sure how to thread that needle. So I'm wondering if you can. Who is Angie Sandow, and why are we talking today?
Okay, well, geez, that's a... Where do I start?
So I know, it's a terrible question.
Well, you know, yeah, I was born, seemed like yesterday, but it wasn't, with a variety of congenital birth defects, the most noticeable of which is limb difference to my right arm and hand. And, you know, all growing up, I never really understood why people were looking at me other than I thought I was, you know, really pretty. And, you know, I never understood the stares and the looks and the points and everything, but my parents always encouraged me to do whatever I set my mind to, which I always did. I always found a way. And why we're here is, I guess I was fortunate enough to meet you all because of a motorcycle. And, I always believe that there is a positive, no matter what comes your way. And that's the way I've approached my life. And case in point is I was diagnosed with breast cancer in February 2014. And that diagnosis really made me realize you can't always wait for that day, you know. And that's what actually motivated me to explore how to ride my my own motorcycle.
Right, which we will talk about. Well, that was great. Actually, you got me off several hooks there. Because as I say, I just, you know, there's sort of no way to, you know, people have asked me, you know, so who are you interviewing for the next episode? And I'm like, I don't know how to start explaining this because she's sort of an awesome person who rides bikes, but she's got this other story. So I appreciate your help there.
Now, my pleasure.
You've described, riding motorcycles as a dream, and I'm using the word that you use, that you decided to make come true. And so I wonder if it might make sense for us to start off by hearing about that dream. When did it first start, and kind of what caused it? How long did you nurture, you know, this fantasy of being able to ride a bike?
Well, I was 5 years old. And my sister was dating a fellow that actually, he was a racer. And he raced at some tracks in Quebec, and he also raced at Daytona. And one day he came to our house, you know, to pick up my sister for a date. And he came on his motorcycle, and he had a guy with him, his buddy. And they both pulled up. And I remember, like, yesterday, for those people that know me, they won't believe this, but I was shy at one time. And she went outside to greet them, and I was standing behind her leg, like peering around her leg to look at. To me, these two guys looked like superheroes. You know, they had the helmets and jackets, and I was fortunate enough to get a ride on both bikes. I wish I could remember what kind of bikes they were, but what I do remember is from the minute I got on the motorcycle, I just felt this joy, I couldn't describe it. And being 5 years old, I was expecting to go for a ride that would never end. And when I discovered it was only going around the block, I wasn't very happy. And when my sister eventually rode off with them, I was even more upset. But what it did was it just got me connected with motorcycles. And I was always into sports. So my dad and I would watch sports all the time. And, you know, at the time, Evel Knievel he was quite the name. And whenever I could see Evel Knievel or motorcycle racing or anything to do with motorcycles, I'm smiling right now just thinking about how excited I would get. And when I was, I guess, preteens, in my area, what became really popular was kids riding mopeds and the mini bikes, and they seemed to be everywhere. So when I think I was about 16, I approached my parents and I said, yeah, I'd really like to get a moped. And they weren't too fond of motorcycles. I think it's the, you know, thing that you hear. It's not that they weren't fond of them. They were concerned. They didn't want me to get hurt. They didn't want me to get injured. You know, they were very concerned because obviously you have no protection or anything. If God forbid something does happen, but as a kid, you're going to live forever. And we had lots of discussions, and eventually I got the moped. And it must have been modified in some way. I can't remember because, you know, because of the limb difference, I only ride with one hand, which is my left. So they must have done something, but I can't remember what it was.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. You know? That's actually amazing that you can't remember. That's so good.
I can't remember. No, you know, I can't. All I remember is I remember mixing the oil with the fuel, you know, before putting it into the tank. I remember doing that. I remember, you know, pedaling like mad to get the thing started. And I remember riding that thing like it was a motorcycle. Like in my head, I was on a motorcycle. Mm. And I used to ride that thing as fast as I could, which eventually burned it out. And the day that I realized it wasn't a motorcycle was when I was riding up a hill to go to school. And I, you know, it's funny how you remember something so vividly. I was in leather pants. I had a leather jacket with fringes. I had a full face helmet with a dark shield. I'm going up this hill. There's a bus behind me. And I'm pedaling like mad to try and get this thing more power. And a 10-speed bicycle went by. And yeah, you're like, you know what? You're not on a motorcycle. That's what started it.
I'm thinking about your outfit, and I'm thinking it sounds like you were a badass right from the get. So did you then keep riding? Or it feels to me like there was a long period of time when you didn't. Is that right?
Yeah. So what happened was, well, I eventually burnt the moped out, and you know, I was living in Montreal, Quebec at the time, and this was late '70s. So I decided to go to a motorcycle dealership. I remember walking in there, and you see all the bikes, and I was all excited. But you know, there was no social media like there is today. I remember speaking with a gentleman about, you know, getting a motorcycle, and he pointed me to scooters. And I remember my heart just sinking. To this day, I remember that sensation. And I know he was being very pleasant and trying to get me something that he felt would work for me. I even sat on one. He said, you sit on one. I did. And, you know, he said, 70cc, it's got more power than what you have now, and it's not very heavy. And I tried to look like I was excited about it, but I kept looking at the bikes and said, there must be something. Are there any modifications that we can do? And he said, no, I'm sorry. There's nothing. And that was the end of it. And then life took over. I would just be a passenger on friends' bikes every so often whenever I could. And, you know, had a band, started working, and really forgot all about it. It just became one of those, yeah, one day. And I'll tell you what reawoke my passion was when I had an AC/DC trib band that I formed in 2001. It was called Bear Rump, right. And I was the Angus, right? So I was a lead guitar player, and I used a prosthetic to play. And we did so many gigs. I mean, in our peak, we were doing like 50 gigs a year. And we did one called Ride for Sight, which is a motorcycle charity, and that's what reawoke my passion of the motorcycles, getting rides on them, and being, you know, just being part of that culture for that weekend when we were playing. But it was still never the right time. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny how universal that story is. I know so many people who kind of were interrupted by adulthood in one way or another. And I was going to ask you what actually made you finally pull the trigger. And I guess the answer is that gig. And I'm going to ask you a bit about that later on, because you're not the first guitarist to be on this show. So just, you know, as a sort of a broad reflection, before we get into some other stuff, I'm curious to know how you would describe what writing does for you. So in your film, which we'll also talk about in a minute, it talks a bit about how your bike sort of sets you free, which makes tons of sense. And you refer to writing as therapy. And I think both of those things are going to be, you know, they're familiar to me and they're probably going to be familiar to most of the people listening to this. But I have to think there's an extra layer of bliss about it for you. How would you describe that feeling? What does it do for you?
It makes me feel like I'm no different than anybody else. You know, I guess for me, even though I'm riding with one hand, I mean, like it or not, you know, I do get looked at to this day. I mean, I look a little different than it. And we all do, right? If you see someone walk by that catches your eye, we all tend to look and everything. But, you know, sometimes the looks that I get are a little bit different. You know, it could be I could see pity in people's faces or, you know, shaking of the head or points. I still get that even now. And when I'm on that motorcycle, I am no different than anyone. I get on that bike, I'm riding. And, you know, for those of us that do ride, we talk about the wind therapy, and I never understood what the heck that meant until I started riding. And you truly just forget all your problems. And you just focus on the joy of being in control, going where you want to go. Anything that you see, you can stop, you can turn. It's just whatever you want to make it. And I've always said even the skunks smell better. And even I still believe it, because you're out there. Once I started riding, I was outside more than I've been in years. And I guess, you know, the other joke, right, that we might say is, you know, you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work, and it's a chore, but you'll get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get on the bike.
Right. Right. Yep. It's true. Yeah. And that sense of leaving your body is seems kind of universal too. You know, it isn't even so much an escape. It's just this sort of, well, anyway, I'm not the one being interviewed here, but I'm nodding while you're talking. So yeah, it really is a universal truth. So we'll probably wander back into that territory in a bit, but I want to talk a little about what it took to make this happen, because that story involves some cool people that I have a lot of affection for. You got it in your head, you wanted to ride. So that moment after the concert that, you know, made you realize this thing had been latent in you and it was time to feed that beast. But clearly a typical motorcycle wasn't going to be, you know, a great fit for you. So tell me what happened next.
Well, you know, like after having that concert and everything and being back with the bikes, I'll be honest with you, you know, I thought about it, and then it was there, it went away. And it was after that breast cancer diagnosis, right? So that was 2014. So, and I said to myself, you know, I got to stop waiting. So I started like surfing to see, to try and get information about people that rode with one hand. And I found so much, it was incredible, but the majority of it was in the United States. So I figured, okay, you know what, maybe we'll go to the motorcycle show and I can get some information. So in, the years, did they just escape you? I think it was like 2016. I went to the motorcycle show it was 2017 with my hubby. And we went to the one in January, so the super show, and walked around, tried to talk to people, but it just didn't seem to be that type of show. No one seemed interested in even talking about mods at that time. So we went to the February show, right? Which is, I always saw that more as a manufacturer's type of show, similar to the car show.
Right.
And I went to every manufacturer. I went to every manufacturer. I sat on bikes. I to see the fit, you know, how I tried to talk to people, and I got really discouraged because no one really would give me the time of day. Like, it just seemed like nobody would take me seriously. The first manufacturer that kind of sorta gave me a bit more than a passing glance was Yamaha. And I was sitting on a V-Star because my husband had got a V-Star the year before. And it felt a little bit too heavy for me. And it, you know, the sales rep was happy to talk to me, but other than that, there was nobody. And, you know, all of a sudden I turned my head to the right and there was a big Honda display. It was huge. And I went over there and I cannot believe to this day, the interest, how they spoke to me. You know, I met this wonderful, wonderful fellow there, Sid, that works for Barry Honda. And, he spent so much time with me, and I'm not talking minutes. I'm talking hours, you know, in between other things that he was doing. And, wow. And he introduced me to the Rebel, you know, the 2017 Rebel. So this was the, when they redesigned it and had the fatter tires, and he got me to sit on it and it felt great. Mm. He introduced me to Nick Smirnu, who is, you know, director. And he started, you know, really filling my head with ways that they thought that, you know, this thing could be, modified. And I remember him saying to me, he said, "Ange, there's no problem. We'll be able to get this done for you." And I went to the moon and back. Like I was so, so, so happy. That's how it started. But believe me, there was a lot of up and downs along the way. But that was the way it actually started to come to fruition.
And then somehow you get hooked up with the guys at Mission Cycle. Yeah.
At that time, you know what, the first guy that did my mods was, Todd at, Mission Cycle in Angus.
Yeah.
And the reason, you know, I got hooked up with him through a friend, and why he was such a good fit was because, you know, we got the bike in at Barry Honda, and then just to go across to Angus, it made it a lot easier to transport the bike. To be honest with you, I didn't even know about motorcycle enhancements at the time. And when I met with Todd, because I think I got the bike in May of 2017. I remember, you know, he came out, he looked at, you know, my seating position. He started telling me all the things that he was thinking about doing. Everything was safety with him. And once he, you know, I went away and he had that bike, I think I started calling him like every day. When's it going to be ready? When's it going to be ready? What are you doing? And he'd send me pictures and you know, we'd go back and forth. And to this day, he says, "I don't know who was more excited about this thing, you or me." Or right. Yeah. So yeah, that's all. It's all started with the Rebel. And he was actually the one that he suggested this. It's like a centrifugal force clutch that he installed. And that actually turned it into a semi-automatic. So the bike would disengage automatically. I would still shift. He mounted what was called a kind of like a finger throttle on the left-hand side. Mm-hmm. And moved my front brake to the left-hand side. So that was my initial setup on my very, very first bike. And, you know, the challenge there too is even when I had it, I had to get someone to train me. And that was one of the other things. Like there were no riding schools that I was aware of at the time that was going to be willing to train me. And I got introduced to Don Redekop at Learning Curves, and he said, "You bring me a bike, you come, you already know how to use your bike. I will teach you." So it's like all the pieces just started coming together. It was amazing. Just amazing.
It is amazing. I'm really, you know, quite touched actually to hear how that went. Cause you just don't hear, you don't hear about industries or industry communities, you know, kind of going that extra mile like that as often as maybe you ought to. And I know Todd, as you know, so full disclosure, that's the shop that works on my bikes, and I think he's amazing. And he's done a few bikes with the kinds of modifications that that you needed. So he had a bit of experience, but he's a natural engineer and just he doesn't look cuddly, but he kind of is. I hope he doesn't listen to this. He doesn't look cuddly at all. But those were sort of significant modifications, it seems to me. Were you worried about that at any point, or were you confident the whole time? I mean, the stakes were pretty high, and this was all kind of new for you. How was that?
Yeah, well, I was, you know, I remember people saying to me when I just prior to purchasing the bike is, "Why would you get a 300? Cause I got the Rebel 300. And I said, "Well, because if things don't work out, you know, I it's a 300. I don't want to invest in a bigger bike." And, I knew that if I didn't feel safe and I didn't feel confident, I wouldn't do it. And I had to ride that bike before I took the course. So I had to be insured as an M1 rider. Right. And I had to get very comfortable on that bike. But I had all the confidence in the world with Todd. I mean, as you said, he's done all kinds of modifications. He takes great pride in that. And he walked me through some of the mods that he did, and it blew me away. So I knew then that, you know, to get this work done, I'm partnering with the right person that really does care about me and wouldn't put me out there if he didn't think I couldn't do it. And he had all kinds of ideas, but with what we what ended up, it was so cool. But my first time ever riding that bike was in Barrie, because my friend picked it up with a trailer and we went to a parking lot. I wish I could tell you where it was. It must've been a Go parking lot, I believe. And I rode that thing for over an hour, and it was the hottest day of the summer. And here's my friend and my husband in the sun. And I didn't even think about them, you know. All I was thinking was, look at me, I'm riding.
Oh, that's so good. One thing that amazed me about that story was how you were able to navigate the provincial licensing system. I never think of our Ministry of Transportation as being, you know, very good at improvising. And I know you would have to have used your bike for your M1 exit, which is not normally the case, among other obstacles. How did you pull that off? How did that all go?
Well, you know, I found out years later, Don Redekop told me, so he's the owner of Learning Curves, and he told me that he spoke with the ministry about the situation, and they had no reason why, I couldn't ride a motorcycle. So I went through the training, and I'll tell you, those guys were fantastic. And they were all about safety. And I remember saying to them, don't treat me differently than anybody else. I want to be treated the same. I remember my instructor saying, what makes you think we treat you differently than anybody else? You know? and even in the training, I dropped the bike on Sunday, the second day of the training. And, I actually did some damage. Like I dented the tank, and we were practicing tight turns to the left, and, I dropped it, and my finger throttle that I had cracked. And I took this course in Markham, Ontario, at the Honda campus, actually. Fortunately for me, there were two guys taking the class actually worked at Honda. And my instructor, one of my instructors, Mohsen, they took the bike. They MacGyvered. So they worked some magic to make that throttle work. And I completed the course that day. And I think I only lost like 2 points or something like that. So I was very proud of myself. That happened. But then when I got my M, I also went through Learning Curves. I did that in Hamilton, actually. And once I got that M and I had my full motorcycle license, that's something they can never take away. It was awesome.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. And I hate to say it, but I think you actually did better than I did on your M1 exit. I did pretty well on my M, but that first test was by the skin of my teeth. So I was going to ask you, to tell me about that first ride after you qualified for your M2. But you can pick between that and the M1 if you like. I remember mine vividly, so I bet you do too. Tell me about leaving the parking lot under your own steam on that bike, a fully licensed rider. How did that feel?
You know, I'm not, I don't, I remember I was crying. Well, I was crying when it was finished, and then I was crying when I was riding, and then I had to pull over. But it was just, I just felt an amazing sense of accomplishment. And I felt like, okay, so now I'm in the motorcycle community. And at the time I didn't really understand what that meant. And I came to realize very quickly, you know, but this might sound a little silly, but when I was a passenger on the back, you know, and you're riding past somebody and you get the salute, you know, the two finger salute type of thing, as a passenger, I would always do it anyway. But when I was on my own bike, when that happened for the first time, I just felt, I don't know, it was just this feeling of I guess recognition and, hey, now I'm riding this bike, and I'm the one that's you know, I'm giving the two finger salute back as the rider of my own motorcycle. And that's what I really remember, was that first time and how I felt with that.
I can so relate. And sort of a sense of belonging too, which is it's weird how hard that hits you. You aren't really ready for it. So I'm curious about this will be a short detour, but I'm curious about your technique, especially about cornering. How does that work? How do you handle counter steering and all that stuff when you've got one point of leverage?
You see, it's all I know, right? All I know is how I do it. And sometimes I'm even riding, I'm going, how am I doing this? But I use my abs, when riding season comes, my abs get a lot stronger. My legs get stronger. My left arm is going to be double the size in a few weeks. and I actually do weights. Like I do a lot of weight training before the season starts just to try and prepare myself. But I just basically lean. It just happens. Where I still have some work to do are on really tight turns. And other fellow riders will tell me, "Wayne, just not just you." There's a lot of us that have to improve on things. But I cannot get that dropping the bike out of my head. I really have to work on that. The wind, I learned to lean into the wind, especially if there's high winds or whatnot. I just lean into it, and I've learned to position the bike in a certain way. When right turns used to be really challenging for me, but, I don't like switchbacks. I'll do them. I don't like them. And I don't like gravel. And I make that clear. I don't like gravel. I have to get better. And, it seems like everybody that rides likes to stop at ice cream places. I don't like ice cream, and usually they have gravel parking lots. So I better figure this out if I want to keep riding with my friends.
Yeah, I'm gravel. We're like brother and sister on that one. So now you've had a few bikes since that first one. I'm guessing you've become a pretty loyal Honda owner. But what are you riding now?
I'm riding a Honda. A Honda CTX 700. It's a cruiser. It's a DCT, so it's got dual clutch, meaning it could be ridden in automatic or manual. The weight distribution is low, so that's really good for me. And I do ride it in automatic. I love that motorcycle. I actually had two of them. I recently sold one, and the reason. One of the reasons I like it so much is because of the dual clutch technology. I mean, you can still ride it manual if you want. It's paddle shifters on the handlebar, but the clutch is stock. And the only thing that we've done is we've just mounted a, it's more like a thumb throttle now. That this is where Motorcycle Enhancements helped me out, where John fabricated a thumb throttle similar to an ATV, and we moved the front brake to the left-hand side. Other than that, that's it. That's all that had to be done.
Wow.
Because in between these two bikes, right, I had a Honda Shadow, and I actually got the Shadow 3 months after getting my Rebel. And that had the same thing. We did the centrifugal force clutch and all that, but it never liked it. I don't know if it was me or the torque of the bike, but the plates would fuse like about every 8,000 kilometers, and it became a real expense to service. So I had to find another option, and the dual clutch has been my savior.
Yeah, I hear good things. Even adventure riders have a sometimes grudging admiration, but admiration nonetheless for how intuitive and brilliant that system is.
That's cool. It's amazing. Yeah, I love it. I haven't had a problem with it. It works so well. It's very smooth shifting. Sometimes when you're going a little slow, you might feel a little ka-junk, ka-junk, like that, but can't complain.
Yeah, that's awesome. It strikes me that the fight wasn't over when you got your license. That you talked a bit about having to stay fit to do this, and I think you ended up with carpal tunnel syndrome last season. I don't know if that was motorcycle related, but it certainly affected your motorcycling. Is it fair to say that you've had to keep fighting to do this, or am I reading too much into it?
No, I think you're right. Well, I developed carpal tunnel in my 20s, believe it or not. It's the first time I ever had fingers go numb. I was swimming and my fingers went numb, and that leads you to go see a neurologist. And I remember first thing I thought is a neurologist. Why do I have to go to a neurologist? But it's a nerve thing. So I got tested And I had really, really mild carpal tunnel. And over the years, it just, it seemed to creep up a bit more and a bit more. And, you know, at night, I'd start shaking my hand because my fingers would get numb. I'd wear a splint, and that became really good for hitting my husband in the head at night. You know, you just roll over and you'd get a clunk with this this thing that I had to wear. So the past few years, it's gotten to the point where sometimes I'd be riding and my thumb and my throttle finger, I guess you could call it, would start going numb. And that's not safe. So I started seeing a specialist, and we started with cortisone injections, but they were only lasting like 3-4 months. So the decision was taken, it's time to get the surgery. I had an appointment, I canceled it, then I had another one, then COVID canceled it. And fortunately, I was able to get the surgery in January of this year. And I'll tell you, it's the best thing that I've ever done. It's been fantastic since then.
Oh, that's good to hear. So yeah. you were off for quite a while then, I think, off the bike for quite a while.
Yeah, well, no, you know what? I was fortunate today. I got it done in the off season, right? But last year, it didn't stop me from riding. I mean, I would just, I'd fight through it. So I still rode, but because I got it done in January, I was nervous that I wouldn't be ready by the time the season came. And, you know, there were some warm days that cropped up earlier, right this year. But I didn't get on the bike until April, like late April, because I just wanted to give it more time to heal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I mean, to me, that sounds like an eternity.
It was.
Well, I was going to ask it. I don't, I hope this isn't an inappropriate observation, but when we first started corresponding to arrange this interview, you had been off the bike for a while, and I think you had the surgery. And spring was kind of taking its time getting here, and obviously you were still healing. And I thought I could sense in your writing that it was getting a little bit tough to keep your spirits up. And so I wonder, is that true? But more importantly, because everybody's spirits need a little help these days, more importantly, how did the time off affect your relationship with riding? I mean, this is a pretty precious thing to you. Having come back to it, you know, as an adult, you know, we all have a little less runway, as well as the struggle that it took to get here. And I don't know if this is adding up to a question that makes any sense, but I'm wondering if that time changed your feelings about riding.
It just made me realize how important it is to me and how precious it is, and not to take, you know, anything for granted. If I wasn't able to ride like tomorrow, it would be very, very painful for me. It also made me focus on some other things. I mean, you know, I started writing and doing some other stuff, and I really fell back on the community, to be honest with you. I mean, because I have over the years met so many wonderful people, and so many people have their own stories. Mm-hmm. And just hearing their stories and their tales. And I mean, when I was going to get this surgery, I reached out to people. I said, "Has anybody had this surgery and what happened?" And it was all positive stuff for the most part. So that picked my spirits up. And that's where I go. I go to my second family when I need a good boost.
Right. Right. I hear that. Yeah, a second family is right.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe kind of connected with that, somewhere along the line, you decided that your story might be of value to other people, that it might provide some inspiration to others. Can you tell me a bit about, you know, when and why that occurred, and how you see your mission?
Sure. When we formed the AC/DC tribute band in 2001, you know, and we started getting gigs, and people would see me play, and over time, I'd start talking to people. They'd come up to me and share their stories with me about certain things that they've overcome, and then, you know, now, Ange, we've seen you play guitar, and what you do, you know, you've really inspired me that I could do this or I could do that. If you could do this, I could do that, and one of the things that I'll never forget is we did a benefit for sick kids, and there was this beautiful little boy, and he was standing to the left of the so-called stage, I'll call it, where we were playing. And I just remember hearing him saying, look at her little arm, look at her little arm. And he was with his father. And when we had our first break, I went over, and his dad said, you know, this is the first time he has smiled in a long, long time. And I you know, when people say things to me like, you know, you inspired me or you motivated me, I tend to get embarrassed because, I'm not looking for recognition, but I did come to realize that I do have something to share. And I really do think I can make a difference based on all the people that I've met. You know, I've seen speakers before talk about different things and everybody's got their own style and presentation, but I share my story just like I play. Like when I would play, I would be right out there with the crowd and talking to people as I was playing and trying to connect with everybody. And that's what I'm trying to do here. And that's what really motivated me was it all started with the band. And I've just taken it to another level now. And actually I can share with you that as a result of that band, you know, you don't realize everything that you do every day and who you're impacting. I actually was approached by this wonderful woman, Marion, regarding the rally in the Rockies, which is in Calgary, Alberta. Hmm. And she actually approached me just a short time ago, and she saw our band. She saw our band play so over 10 years ago, and she remembered. She remembered Bear Rump, and she remembered seeing me and how I play. And now I'm going to be participating in the rally next year. And it's, I guess that really helps you realize, you don't realize who you're reaching, you know, when you're doing the things that you're doing. That's why I felt, yeah, you know what, let's take this to another level and make a documentary where I can share my story and hopefully demonstrate what you can achieve and the importance of not judging people based on appearance.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you about the film in a second. So when we met, it was at that bike show in Toronto. I don't remember how many years ago it was. I just remember that I met you between getting rear-ended in my truck and meeting Freddie Spencer. So it was pretty memorable anyway, but, So you kind of leapt into the aisle and handed me a patch, which I still have, that said, why discourage when you can encourage? And the thing that struck me about that was that it seemed like a message for everybody else, not for the people who actually need the encouragement. And so I was sort of dying to ask, is there a story there?
You know, it's just this phrase that came to me one day. I honestly don't even know where it came from. I know when I first thought of it was when I was going through breast cancer and the treatment and trying to keep, you know, my positivity up, and people were encouraging me. And you just going through something like that, you really have time to reflect on things that you've done in your life. And it just seemed to me that more now than ever, that it's easy to be down on yourself, on other people. We don't tend to share positives. We don't tend to raise positives. And that could be enough for some people to just give up, to lose hope, even strong people. And I just felt like this is a message that I think is simple. And that hopefully if it can reach somebody, that you realize that, hey, you know what you're doing or saying has an impact on that person that you're talking to. So try and do it in a positive way.
Yeah. Well, it's good advice. There's no doubt about it. But I kind of like the leading with your jaw kind of vibe of it. So I know you've done a bit of public speaking and you're getting some media attention. I think I saw you in the Globe recently. So I have to imagine that your message is pretty dialed in at this point. Can you share with us in a few sentences what it is you're trying to say? What do you want people to get from what you've accomplished here?
That you can do anything you set your mind to, and that limitations are okay. We all have limitations, all of us. And it doesn't matter if it's one hand, one leg, or you have, you know, I remember everything seems to be so long ago. I remember when I started working, I worked at this company and I was doing order desk clerk. And back then you'd write the order down on a piece of paper and then you key it into the system. And my manager at the time, I once told him, you know, I can do anything. So if you need me to do something, just let me know what it is. And back then we kept our invoices in these banker boxes, you know, so you have a lot of paper and a lot of volume. And I hated this thing, you know, because you'd have to unhook this hinge and you'd have to find the invoice, a lot of paper. And I found it a cumbersome process. So I used to, instead of putting the invoices back where they should, I would put them in a tray and I'd ask someone else, could you please do this? So one day my manager calls me over and he goes, Ange, you told me that you could do anything, you know, so why aren't you putting the invoices back? I said, I find it to be a cumbersome process. It has got nothing to do with my hands, but you've got two hands. Can you play guitar? So I remember he said to me, you're going to give me a heart attack. So, you know, that's why I when I speak, it's just about sharing the things that you can accomplish. And yes, you will face adversity along the way. Absolutely. We all do. But don't lose hope. Mm-hmm. You know, where there's a will, there's a way.
When you sort of became, when you decided to commit yourself to this, did you have someone in mind, a sort of a picture in your head of the sort of person who needs to hear what you've got to say? Who are they?
Well, I think I thought about, there were a few things. I thought about some, you know, there was one teacher I thought about specifically when I was going to elementary school that wouldn't let me participate in gym class when they were doing pitch and catch because she told my dad that I couldn't catch a ball and he set her right on that. So, you know, and then there were people that were the exact opposite, you know, because I played hockey and I was a goalie and, you know, I was playing with I played shinny and I was playing with kids that were, when I was 12, they were like nearly 20. So I guess all of that and thinking the thing that really stuck with me, and I've mentioned it earlier, were the looks and based on the looks, people judging. And it wasn't just my arm. You know, when I was a teenager, young teenager, I got heavy. I think I put on about 20 pounds and I was less than 5 feet and I weighed 130 some odd pounds. So that's a pretty big kid. And, got looked at then and got judged then. And so all of that just stayed with me and how I felt and how it made me feel. You know, and I was bullied a little bit growing up. And the unfortunate reality was I became a bit of a bully as a result because I felt that finally people left me alone and they didn't bother me anymore, but quickly learned that that wasn't the right way to react. So that was everything that I was thinking of. And in addition to the impact that I made to people when I was in the AC/DC trip band and, you know, we got a classic rock band now and, well, we're not playing these days, unfortunately, but even when we do, you know, still people sharing stories, even when I was going through treatment and I'd be waiting for chemo, people would just start talking to me. And I once asked my mother, I said, why do you think people are just talking to me and sharing their stories? You know, and she says, because you come across as very approachable and caring and they feel that they can get something out of you. And I thought, you know what, then that's all of this came together. And I thought, it's time. I can't keep waiting for tomorrow. I think it's time. And I do have something of value to share that will help people.
It's interesting. There's a bit of a thread running through this that has to do with childhood. Do you imagine yourself speaking to kids as part of your, you know, as part of your kind of mission? I mean, I you know, God knows I would love to go and speak at my high school, but that's another story. I mean, does that audience, not audience is the wrong word, but do kids kind of speak to you as being especially in need of this kind of encouragement?
I think that, you know, when I think of where I could share my story, I mean, I think there's all kinds of demographics that I can address, but the kids are really, I think would be a great audience. It's tough building the connections. And I especially these days with COVID and there's so much negativity and people are so down but there's so much anger in the world and judging and, you know, people are trying to find themselves. And I think now more than ever, everybody needs a positive story. But yes, I would love to speak to the kids. You know, a couple of years ago, we actually did a gig, I guess you could say, at a kids carnival for kids with cancer that was organized by Wellspring, which you know, offer services for cancer patients and their caregivers. And just talking to those kids was the coolest thing. They inspired me, you know. And I think it should be reciprocal, you know, because we all can still learn and grow.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. I wonder how it's been for you trying to build a platform like this so far. So, you know, I think most motorcyclists to a greater or lesser extent are kind of solitary. You know, I mean, it's a generalization, obviously, but I have to think, I mean, I've had a tiny experience trying to do this to promote a book a few years ago, and it was difficult, and I was so awkward and terrible at it. And so I wonder, for you, how has it been? Has this been just another challenge, or is it pretty natural for you to platform build like this?
It is a challenge for me. I mean, you know, like with my band, my husband, the drummer, Lloyd, he books all the gigs, so he sells the band and everything. I'm not good at selling myself. I am not good at selling myself. It is a challenge for me. I've been successful with speaking at cancer events and motorcycle events. I actually was supposed to speak at Americade in Lake George last year, and I have an opportunity to speak this year. Hopefully the borders will be open by the end of September, because they've changed dates this year. They pushed it back. I was supposed to participate in Women in Motorcycling in Virginia, actually, in August, you know. So from the motorcycle community, I find it easier to work with people. But you really have to invest a lot of time, make a lot of calls and emails and everything else to all these other organizations to get in there. And it's not the easiest thing for me, but I'll make it happen for sure.
I don't doubt that. It sounds like the motorcycle community has been pretty supportive.
Yeah, very.
That's good to hear. I wonder what they have in their minds when they book you. So maybe another way of asking the question is, who do you think in the motorcycle community needs to hear this? Is there a community within this community that you think needs this kind of encouragement?
Well, you know, it depends on who your audience is, right? So, you know, like for instance, when I organize, you know, the women in motorcycling at the Spring Motorcycle Show in Toronto, and there is a demographic of women that, you know, by sharing my story, I think it inspires them that yes, you can ride your own bike. And even people that I, the women that I've met in different areas, they seem to be, you know, inspired by that, that not only am I a woman, but I, you know, the way I ride and I've heard talk that sometimes women feel that they don't, or they're not part of the motorcycle community, depending on who they're associated with. And so I think there's a whole thing about acceptance there. And, so that's one thing, but I think within the motorcycle group as a whole, what I found is that people are very intrigued with how I'm able to accomplish what I've accomplished. And I think from a motorcycle rider, we've all faced different challenges, different opportunities when we're riding, you know? And I think from hearing my story, someone will say, oh my God, well, I faced this situation and you're on your bike and you had that situation. How the heck did you cope with it? How did you manage it? And if you could overcome that, well, maybe I should consider doing this, that, or the other thing. So I think, you know, my story, I was once told that my story has so many chapters that I have too much to talk about, and I have to gear it to whomever my audience is, you know?
Yeah.
But from a motorcycle thing, I sometimes I'll be honest, you know, when I park the bike and I get off the bike, I take my jacket off and everything, I'll say to my husband sometimes, well, nobody's even looking at me, and I've got this great story to tell. You know, you just, and that's what I mean about the acceptance part, which is awesome, right? But I think it helps us all look at ourselves. And I'll be honest, I could be a procrastinator too sometimes. But I think it just helps us raise awareness about what we can achieve. At the end of the day, I think sometimes we all need someone to help us realize that we can do things that maybe we thought wasn't possible.
Yeah, which kind of leads to the next thing I wanted to ask you about. So, and still sort of on the subject of the motorcycle community, I wonder what you think about this. I've heard from a number of listeners who found their way to motorcycles, you know, well into adulthood. And, you know, with nearly no history or, you know, very little history or in some cases no history, and they kind of go out and find this thing in their 40s or in their 50s or in their 60s even. And the message that they always have is kind of like, why did I wait so long? And it feels a bit like regret. You know, it's a bit rueful or, you know, almost kind of sad that they didn't find this sooner because it makes them so ecstatic. And I wonder if you have, you know, as somebody who's thought a lot about not taking this for granted, I wonder if you have any words of wisdom for people, you know, in that situation, which would include me, about making up for lost time.
Just go do it. You know, I hear what you're saying because I feel the same way. You know, I sometimes I beat myself up and say, well, back in the late 70s when you were in that dealership, why didn't you push the issue? You know, why didn't you get motorcycle magazines? The Honda-matic was out. Why, you know, how did I miss that and everything? But you can look at that for just about anything, eh? Hindsight's 2020. So I look at, enjoy where you are today. Enjoy it. You're doing it. Maximize your time doing it, and just be thankful that you have an opportunity to do it, because other things may have come along the way that prevented you from doing it. So, you know, that's the way. Take joy that you can do that now, and make the most of it every day that you can.
Yeah. Just do it. I think is, I think if this podcast had a, you know, was to have an alternative title, it would probably be just go.
Just go. I like that.
I'll take that. So you recently made, a short documentary film, which is called Angie Tales of Determination. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about that a bit. How did that come about? What did you, what made you decide to do it? And how was it born?
Well, you know, when I started riding and I became more involved in the motorcycle community, I actually started writing, and I learned about Toronto Motorcycle Film Festival, which I never knew existed, and checked out some of the films. You know, it's a relatively new festival, and I was really intrigued by some of the films. So I thought, hey, I've got a story. I would love to make a documentary that hopefully will be accepted by the Toronto Motorcycle Film Festival, not knowing that there's a world of festivals out there. So I was blessed to connect with Christopher Darton, who directed and produced it. I came to him with my idea. We actually started filming it last February. So February 2020, we started. And it's just really high level. It was just, I said, you know, I just want to tell my story, more focused on the motorcycle part of my story, because I was thinking about the Toronto Motorcycle Film Festival. I'll tell you, the coolest part of it was the interviews. We got a lot of people to participate in interviews, and I knew I wanted the final scene to be me with my family. And in an area that we could all be filmed together. And I decided on tons of bike gear, because that is an incredible store with incredible people that support the motorcycle community and have done so for years. And they have a large parking lot, and they're so, so supportive. And the coolest thing was, we rode out there, and in total, I think we were about 15, 16 bikes. We were around 10, 11 that left from my house, picked up some other riders along the way, and then we pulled into the parking lot and filmed the last sequence. And that was amazing. The support that I got from the community, because, you know, I'm on Facebook a lot with Just Riding, which is my social media platform. And I put it out there that I was looking for people to be part of this. And what I really wanted to do too was to share stories from other people. And we had a few other folks that ride and that have overcome challenges to ride, and they were briefly able to tell their stories as well. And that's what it's all about. So I found out through Chris that there's all these film festivals. So it's been accepted by two so far. It's been nominated in a variety of different categories by the Hollywood North Film Festival in Toronto. There's a Portland Motorcycle Film Festival that right now, I should find out in June if they're going to accept it. And I'm crossing my fingers big time for Toronto Motorcycle Film Festival, which I should know by July 30th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
That's amazing. And the guy who directed it, Christopher Darton, did you say was his name?
Yes.
He's not a bike guy though, right? He's a film.
He's not a bike guy. No, he's not.
So what do you think? I'm
sorry,
I interrupted you.
No. Sorry, no, I did.
No. We're so Canadian. I was just going to ask, what do you think he saw in this? Given that he's not, in quotes, one of us, he must have seen something kind of universal in it. What do you think that was?
I think he just believed in the story, and he felt that it was a story that had to be told. And I think he did a great job at doing it, and he had a lot of fun. We got a lot of good shots for, someone that doesn't ride. He had some really cool ideas about different angles and things. But I think that was the thing too. Like, I didn't want it to be so much of the motorcycle riding. I wanted it to be more of the overall story of what got me into riding and how I ride and what it does for me,
Yeah.
So he was a perfect fit for that because he's done documentaries before and he's a very caring individual. And really, if he believes in that story, boy, he'll do his best to put it out there in a certain way. And I'm very pleased and proud of the film. I really am.
Yeah. Well, you should be. It should be. It's wonderful. And people who direct films are often pretty special people. And I get the sense in yours that he had great affection for the subject, and it shows. I kind of looking at you through his eyes a little bit had to do with how you think the motorcycle fits into your persona. Let's use that word. So it's easy for us as riders to look at what you've done and look at the motorcycle as being an instrument for achievement and liberation and all the things that we've talked about, and of course for the joy that it can bring. But I think to a wider audience, if you find yourself talking to people who are not riders, I wonder what the bike means to your brand. Is that a terrible word to use? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so.
good. Thank you.
And that's a great question. I my whole life, I never knew what the word can't meant. It was never part of my vocabulary. And I think the motorcycle represents just that, When I wanted to start riding, I had a lot of friends that were encouraging me, but I also had some friends saying, Ange, I don't think you should do that. It's dangerous. Meanwhile, they take me as a passenger on the back of their bike. Right. Or, Ange, you know what? Look at a spider, which is great. Spider's a great ride. It's a fantastic ride, but we can't lean, on a spider. And so for me, this is the ultimate that, tell me, one of my sayings is tell me I can't and I will. And I think that the bike represents that because there were a lot of hurdles to overcome in order to make this happen. And yeah, a lot of it was timing and the right place at the right time and the right people and all that, but it all happened for a reason. And I think that bike could be anything. That bike could be somebody else might have a different thing that they want to accomplish. And that's their motorcycle, and I think sometimes when people can see it, because especially when I have it at the show and, to look at the bike, right? I mean, it doesn't look any different than any other bike. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't even know. But once I really get into it and talk about it and explain, wow, people really start thinking about, wow, it's amazing that if all this can happen, then whatever their motorcycle is, and it might very well be a motorcycle, they can do it too.
I love that. What's your motorcycle? That starts to make a ton of sense. Cause I was going to, so we'll wander back into that territory in a second. This is the risk you take when you come on this podcast, is that things will get nerdy. So on the subject of persona, as I mentioned earlier, you are one of a long line of writers I've met who are also guitarists. And, you know, that's going to be somebody else's PhD to figure out why those two things seem to go together so often. But do I have this right that Angus and Malcolm Young of AC/DC taught you to play Thunderstruck? Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And it happened in St. Catharines, of all places, St. Catharines, Ontario. They were doing a promo for Stiff Upper Lip, and it was Angus Malcolm and the drummer Phil was there. And I can't even remember the name of the bar where they did this. But my husband won through 97.7 Hits FM. We got in, and I was dressed as Angus, and I just asked them.
just ask them.
It's funny, that was an interesting evening, you know, because there was an AC/DC tribute band that was going to play after. And, you know, I had Angus on one side, I had Malcolm on the other side. They grabbed the guitar that was actually belonged to a member of the tribute band that hadn't started playing. I mean, they were still doing the interviews and things like that. And he just showed it to me. And I remember I said to them, well, you know, I've been trying to figure this out, but I'm a visual. So if someone shows me, and here I am with one on one side and one on the other, and I made the mistake. I remember, you know, Malcolm said, you know, you just got to practice. You just got to practice. And I said, yeah, but unlike you, I said, I have a real job, you know. I didn't mean it the way it came out. You see, you talk about what you say and how it makes people feel. And here's Malcolm Young looking at me and goes, I have a real job. I said, no, I don't mean it that way. I said, you know, 9 to 5, we got these commitments where your real job is you can sit and play, right? But we made up. No, but I'll never, ever, ever forget that. And I had the good fortune to meet them a few times after that, and even talked to Malcolm about the prosthetic and how I showed it to him and how I played, and he gave me some suggestions. And that night when they taught me Thunderstruck was the night that I came up with the idea to form an AC/DC tribute band.
So good. And so they taught you to do it and you picked a fight with them.
Yeah. Oh, so, you know, there's a few things that happened that night when, because, you know, Angus is a smaller guy. He's, you know, and my hubby looked at him and said to him, hey, Angus, you're a short little bastard, just like me. And I hear myself saying, don't swear at Angus. What was going through my mind? I don't know.
A picture starts to emerge. So here's a kind of a theory. And tell me what you think. It seems to me that one of the things that bikes and guitars have in common, and I've had a conversation similar to this at the episode before last with Eric Buell, so you're not the first victim. It seems to me that the one thing bikes and guitars have in common is that they're both essentially solo endeavors. You know, even if you're in a band, you're kind of alone together, so to speak. And there's something about that instrument that's kind of all up to you. You know, you do the work, you take the risk, you get the glory, or you pay the price. And I think there's something that appeals to the motorcyclist's soul about that. And I say that as a player, not a very good player, but, you know, I wonder if you see that parallel. Does it resonate for you? Do you think, so back to my earlier question about your, you know, how do bikes fit into your persona? How do they license you to tell people, what you have to tell them? I wonder if that's the connection.
Do you know, I never even thought about that. That's, wow. I don't really know.
Fair enough.
But you know, you're right. You're right. With when you're playing, you're kind of on your own with a group. And yeah, it's, you're out there. and you know, in our current band, like I'm the lead singer. So what does that mean?
Worse yet. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, no, well, fair enough. It, it's, I realized it was kind of an odd thing, but it struck me that these things seem to somehow go together. Your chin outness and, you know, the fact that you ride and the fact that you play the guitar. And if I'm a motorcyclist, you make sense to me as a motorcyclist, but if I'm just an ordinary person, you know, what do they see? And I think somehow this completes the picture. I think you think that too. It looks, you know, from your website, you definitely share that part of yourself. So thanks for playing along. So I'm always curious when I meet someone who's been on a journey like this. Do you have heroes? Did someone or did multiple someones along the way inspire you? Is there some photograph, you know, pinned to the wall in your mind about you know, that your you know, your spirit animal, so to speak?
Yeah, actually, there's a few. I mean, you know, I've mentioned I'm really into sports, and when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Bobby Clark, and this was in the 70s with the Broad Street Bully. So I might be dating myself a little bit. And, you know, he has diabetes. So I'm saying this with quotations. He shouldn't be playing hockey, you know. So he really inspired me. Doug Flutie was too short to play football. But he had a really good career. Those are two people that really, you know, Angus, like I mentioned, is very, very small guy. And he's got, you know, his reach and how he plays and how he has to twist his body to, people don't realize that, you know, to play. That just blew me away. And those were really the three big ones that really made an impact on me growing up. You know, that I, if they could do it. And I guess, you know, there's actually a couple more, like Derek Jeter. And you see how a lot of this goes around sports. I mean, Derek Jeter, you know, he was called all kinds of names and stuff when he was just getting into baseball, and he became one of the best shortstops ever. And I always thought that, you know, he had this strength that he just believed in himself. I guess all of them, you know, the confidence that they had in themselves. And then my all-time favorite would be Mr. Henrik Lundqvist, who is my favorite goalie. He always has been since he started to play the game. Yes, I'm a New York Rangers fan. I was inspired by him because he wasn't even a top draft pick. He you know, and he became one of the best goalies in the NHL. So always fighting adversity and having to deal with naysayers and things like that. So those were the ones that really, really resonated with me.
Yeah, good answers. But I noticed there are no motorcyclists on the list. Do you want to reconsider that, or have we just not?
if I had to put one, then it would be back to what I said in the beginning, would be Evel Knievel. And the reason Evel Knievel kind of inspired me was he kept picking himself back up, right?
Yep.
And I had that original Evel Knievel toy, and believe me, my toy didn't jump any better than the real Evel Knievel. But, you know, yeah, I mean, anybody that I saw that just had to overcome and just kept fighting and fighting and fighting to achieve what it was that they felt, you know, they wanted to do. Those were the big ones that to this day still inspire me. And I'm sure there's going to be some new names that come up along the way. There are incredible people out there.
Yep. Yeah, especially in this community. I'm sure there are lots of communities that can make the same claim, but certainly for, you know, for us, it seems like, you know, about one out of four people I meet on a bike, I walk away, you know, humbled in some way. So we probably both got lots of heroes ahead of us that we haven't even met yet. Speaking of ahead of us, it seems like we might get let off the leash a bit this summer here in Ontario. Do you have any big rides planned? Is there anything special you're going to do to reward yourself for making it through the winter?
Well, I'm praying that the border opens. I am just praying it opens. I don't think it will, but I'm praying that it does. And if it does, just to get to the Finger Lakes would make me happy. Really wanted to get to Quebec, and I wanted to do the, you know, the Gaspé. I've never been. We wanted to go out east and do the Cabot Trail. Never been. But I just don't anticipate it happening. So what I'm doing is I'm actually building something for next year. And there's a couple of things. I mean, next year would be tied in with the rally in the Rockies, and I'm working on organizing this, something called Just Riding with Ange, where I'm going to organize a ride from Ontario, starting somewhere in Ontario, going all the way to Calgary, Alberta, pick up riders along the way, and raise awareness about Rally in the Rockies and myself and my story, and have some stops along the way where I can share my story and meet people. And I'd really, really love to meet just about anybody that's overcome anything to succeed at what it was, what's their dream, whether it's riding a motorcycle or anything else. And I'll be blogging and vlogging that. I also want to ride across the United States. So that would probably be the year after. This year, I mean, if we're fortunate enough, I mean, I'd just be thrilled if I could just get out of my house and stay in a hotel somewhere other than like down the street, you know. We've got some ideas. I mean, we've been to Calabogie and Bob Cajun and those areas. I like to go east, and because it's closer to the Quebec border. And being born and raised in Montreal, I don't know, especially now, maybe because we've been kind of locked up for so long, there's something calling me back to Quebec. It's so I'm hoping at least we can cross and get into Quebec and then get to Montebello and ride around there. So it's kind of high level right now. I felt like I don't want to plan something and then I'm just going to get discouraged if we can't do it, but we do have some time booked. So I'm hoping that we can. I wanted to go around Lake Superior too, but the only challenge is if the border's not open, I don't feel like going all the way up to go halfway, you know?
Right. Right. That's right. Yeah. It's beautiful up there too.
Yeah.
I wonder if anywhere in your plans you're curious about other styles of riding. I wonder if, riding a dirt bike or an ADV bike or doing a track day or any of those things have tickled your fancy at any point. Do you ever think about that?
I would love to try a dirt bike, and I would love to try an adventure bike and do all different kinds of, you know, roads. The only thing is, I mean, A, it has to be modified, and with the adventure bikes that are out there right now, like I need a step stool to get on it because,
yeah,
you know,
there is that.
I mean, right, there is the Africa, right, and it's dual clutch and everything, but there's no way I can get on that thing, but I'd love to. I'd love to try different kinds of riding. That really intrigues me. I'd love to make it happen someday. But, you know, one of the biggest challenges is, and I'll be reaching out to my friend Todd. I already actually started talking about it because, you know, new bikes aren't cable throttle and it's fly-by-wire. So the trick is, how are we going to make that happen? It's not going to be as easy as cable.
Yeah, it certainly shortens the list. That's for sure. I don't think there are too many brand new ADV bikes that are not ride-by-wire anymore, but I could be wrong about that. But if anybody can do it, Todd can.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
He was determined that we should meet. And I mean, you were already kind of in my plan, but he was like, he had my ninja hostage for the winter. And he was like, you gotta call Angie Sandow. This has to happen. So yeah, he'll be the guy. Dirt bikes. I mean, I have seen amazing people do amazing things on dirt bikes, people that you would not think would be well suited to that sport. And I have not tried myself yet, but I understand the attraction.
Yeah, and I like speed, you know. And when I used to ride that moped, I was a racer, and I would ride that thing. I would take a route, and I try and do it faster and faster, and lean it over more and more, and really push it. And to get on a race bike on a track, oh my God, that would be the ultimate. That would be the absolute ultimate. And I mean, there's hope there, because I'm even aware of a group in the States where they're paralyzed and they race. And I've seen other riders that, you know, have all kinds of challenges they've overcome, and they're doing it. So that too inspires me that, again, it's possible. And just how are we going to make it happen?
Yeah.
But that would be amazing. Amazing.
I'm excited for you. Well, look, Angie, it's been so great speaking with you. I'm really glad we were finally able to make this happen. It took far too long, but I really appreciate you sharing your story with me.
Oh, no. Hey, listen, it's my pleasure. I still remember the day we met, and I hope that we can get out and ride together.
Well, right? you know where to find me.
Yeah, I do. Believe me, it's nicer going up your way than coming down where I am. So.
Yeah. Well, that'd be great. We promised we were going to do this last summer. It didn't happen, but if we get a chance this summer, let's do that. I'd love it. And I'd love to see your husband again. He's a pretty cool guy.
Oh, thanks. He is.
Well, in the meantime, ride safe out there, and thanks again.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I think it's great what you're doing. Your show's amazing. And,
thank you.
It is. You've got great guests, and thank you.
Well, until next time, then, take care. Bye now.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Angie Sandow wants us to know that we can do anything if we put our minds to it. And she thinks we should all try to be a little kinder to each other. And I guess I could stop there, and this would still be time well spent. A kind of inspiring affirmation of what keeps a lot of us going. But for me, the moment in this conversation when I felt like I was right there was when she talked about riding home for the first time as a newly licensed motorcyclist. About crying in her helmet, and about the feeling of belonging when she returned that first wave on the road. Well, do you remember that day? I sure do. And I know I've talked about this before, but to re-experience that rush of liberation and pride and possibility again in this conversation, especially with all it took to get there, well, that was an inspiration too. So, yes, I believe her when she says you can do anything you set your mind to. But even for those of us whose path was easier, it was also pretty great to be reminded of how it felt to succeed at this. How very worth it it's been. And how lucky we are to be out there together, no matter what it took. Well, thanks for listening. You'll find show notes for this episode at thismotorcyclelife.com. And that's also how you can reach me if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, of which I'm getting quite a list. ThisMotorcycleLife@gmail.com works too, and I'd love to hear from you. You can also follow me on Instagram, where I'm @ThisMotoLife, and where you'll also find many of the people I've interviewed for this podcast, including Angie Sandow. For this episode's playlist recommendation, the track Can Only Be Thunderstruck, the AC/DC classic that Angie learned to play from the band who wrote it. Well, there are a lot of versions and interpretations of this track out there, partly because it's such a classic, and partly because it's difficult. And it's that second reason that made me choose this instrumental performance as a tribute to Angie's story. It's by Italian guitar prodigy Luca Stricagnoli. Give it a listen, or even better, watch it, and tell me you don't believe anything is possible. Buy it or stream it wherever you like to get your music. And in the meantime, keep staying alive out there.